Today is the 20th of January 2015. I'm here to do take two of the life and times of Dave Ward. So Dave, if you could just run over where we've been.
For the last 20 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay. My parentage hails from Tyneside in the northeast of England, particularly a town called South Shields, which is on the Tyne. My father was a ship's furniture maker with the Middle Docks on Tyneside, but he lost his job, as many thousands did, in the Great Depression of 1929, and he turned his hand to teaching. He had his City and Guilds, I think it was called. He did a year, I think, at Loughborough College and took up woodwork teaching. My mother was a well-qualified pastry chef, which was wonderful for the food that we eat. I was born shortly after the outbreak of the First World War in September 1939. My father was a fairly astute kind of guy, and he saw the problems that were about to befall us, and we moved from South Shields to Appleby in Westmorland, or Cumbria as it now is. For the first 5 years of my life, of course, I didn't have a father because he was called up. He spent the war years in the REME, Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, and he was involved in with a team doing radar research. And he became a very competent electronics radio technician. But he chose to stay with woodwork when he came out of service. My father was very unsettled when he was demobbed, and after only, I think, a year, we moved down to Feltham in Middlesex.
Well, when you say we, you have brothers and sisters?
I have one sister, 3 years older than me, and my mother. Yep. The four of us moved.
Yep, sure.
And we lived with a remote branch of the family for 6 months, which was a bit of a disaster. My father was teaching in Woking in Surrey. He was going across London every day and back. But after 6 months, it was obvious that there was nothing down there for us. Housing was incredibly short. Mm-hmm. And people were moving into prefabs, which were going up by the thousand. So we moved back to South Shields, which was another disaster, because every school we went to was doing something different in my educational experience, and I was just getting left further and further behind. After a disastrous 2 years at South Shields, where I was also picking up with street kids, which my parents didn't approve of, mm-hmm. we moved back to Appleby. In 48, in 1950, I passed my 11-plus exam to get into Appleby Grammar School. Appleby Grammar School, a very good school, very small, only 160 pupils, serving a very large area. Appleby only had a population of 1,600 people, and it serviced about 14 villages in the area, going out perhaps 5 or 6 miles.
Sure.
I enjoyed school, but I was absolutely useless academically. I joined the Geographical Society, Debating Society, and I became a school cadet. I came out of that as a corporal in the Cadet Force. Cadet forces were run by the local regiments. In my case, it was the Border Regiment. And you were treated like soldiers. You did all the drill and the ball and etc. And I also came out qualified as a communications tutor.
Right.
Which was the beginning of Sirtrack a long time later. Yes, just links. I didn't do very well at school. I was slow to find out what learning was about. But I struggled and succeeded in passing six subjects at O level, and went on into the sixth form, and struggled there, and failed dismally in my A-levels, passing only one subject, having spent 2 years playing the drums in a jazz band, which half a dozen of us had put together. We had our own garret at a town called Kirby Stephen, 16 miles up the valley, and we had a swinging jazz club every Saturday night. Very entertaining, and I learnt a lot. Having failed to achieve access to London University, where I had been accepted to do a degree in horticulture, I chose to stay with horticulture and pursue a national diploma, which was a 6-year course. I gained entrance to the Hertfordshire Institute of Horticulture down south, but I had to do a year on a mixed nursery to start with to get some field experience, practical experience, which I did. Fortunately, in town, there was a very, very good nursery which was way ahead of its time. It was already commercially using trickle irrigation, hydroponics, extended day treatment. It was grafting things that had never been grafted before. Mm-hmm. It really was a leading nursery and very good grounding for me. My year in Hertfordshire was very successful. I'd found a niche that I could manage, and I passed out top student and gained a number of external exam qualifications which helped towards national diploma. From there, I needed experience in vegetable work, so went to a major farm in Surrey along with 30 other students from all over the country for a year's experience. Very hard work, everything was done on piecework, very long hours, but we also got lectures at night from the staff, which is good. I, during that time, had decided that I did want to travel. I had no money, but I found I could get to New Zealand for nothing if I had a job. Mm. And I went through the process of applying for passage and interviews at New Zealand House in London, and was accepted. I organised a job in Palmerston North at R.E. Harrison's and Sons, who were tree and shrub specialists. And I moved from there, from Surrey, I moved up back to the Lake District. I thought I'd spend the last 2 or 3 months near home, keep my parents happy, because Mum wasn't very pleased about me going off on my own at age 22. But as it turned out, my stay in the Lake District ran to something like 15 months, because New Zealand House moved very slowly. But I had a very good time in the Lake District. The nursery I worked at was run by a landscape architect who had very good business in the Lake District, specialising in rock gardens particularly. But I came out to New Zealand by ship, of course. I arrived in March 1962 and went up to Palmerston North, where I worked for a year in a very large nursery. Acres, hundreds of acres of trees and shrubs. Soul destroying, you know, budding 10,000 roses, back bent day after day. And after a year, I thought there was no challenge in this. No. There was nothing rewarding. I had to do 2 years before I went back to Britain, stay 2 years or refund New Zealand House with the cost of your passage, which was, I think, £150. So I thought, I'll move. I'll do something different for my second year. And I opened the Manawatu Evening Standard that evening, having made this decision while budding roses. And there, the very first job in situations vacant was an advert for a field technician to work with small mammals, must be prepared to work alone and to live alone for short periods, and prepared to spend time away from home in the field. And I thought, that's me. All my life I'd been very interested in natural history. At the age of 10, I was a charter member of a natural history society in Appleby. A whole bunch of very important people, very keen bird watchers, decided Appleby could support a natural history society. Appleby is on the River Eden, and they called it the Eden Field Club. I don't think I missed a meeting in the subsequent 8 years that I was living in Appleby. Very good lectures during the winter and field trips once a month during the summer. Yes. Bird banding, geology, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Really good. And I fell on my feet. Interestingly, I went for an interview to Lower Hutt, which is where the office was. And the person who interviewed me, a Dr. John Gibb, was asking me about my experience with wildlife. And of course I'd had very little actual experience. I was telling him about the Eden Field Club. And he said, give me some names. So I mentioned two or three names. And one of the big names was Bill Robson, who was a well-known ornithologist in the north. And he looked at me and he said, Bill Robson, you mean Robson R.W.? I said, yes, Bill Robson. Good God, he said. When he was doing his PhD at Oxford University, he earned pocket money by working at the bird ringing centre. And Bill Robson was a very keen bird ringer and was always sending in reports of having spotted birds with this band or that band, and he caught it, read the number and let it go again, send the number down to the bird centre. And he had frequently corresponded with John Gibb. The job was mine. And it was a wonderful job. My first work was designing an electric fence to keep cats out of a 20-acre pen in which rabbits were being studied, the population dynamics of rabbits. And from there I was down to the Nelson Lakes National Park working on hares and deer observations, and up into the Ruhinis shooting deer and collecting jaws so we could pull the teeth out, so we could measure the age of the deer. And it just went on like that. It was wonderful.
He's this rock climbing man in his,
element. And from then on, I would have to say, okay, we had some stressful times, had some hair-raising times, but I never actually did a day's work.
Yes.
I felt for the next 40 years that I was being paid to do a hobby.
Yes, well, see, it was interesting. You started off by saying that you were in communications when you were a cadet, and that helped a little bit to where you ended up. Also, you made mention of banding birds, being a charter member of this club.
Mm.
The whole thing was being predestined for you, wasn't it?
It's interesting that that's how it fell together.
Yes.
All right, I was very much a junior technician, learning very hard. I think I was doing correspondence courses and going to day release classes at Polytech and at university almost every year for probably the next 20 years.
This is a manner of...
In Lyme. I went to a statistics course at Wellington Polytech every Friday morning for 3 years. I knew more stats than the senior scientist in the organisation.
Because stats are not the most interesting.
It isn't, but it's essential in working with the data that we were gathering. Yes, I went back to Britain I was unsure whether I'd made the right choice by doing what I'd done. I wasn't sure that New Zealand was the place for me. I'd left a lot of friends back in Britain. I had to go back and get my head around what I'd done. They gave me 6 months' leave of absence. Leave without pay, but I had enough to get back to Britain and was over there. But within 2 weeks I knew, this is ridiculous. New Zealand's the place. The attitude, the narrow-mindedness, the parochial approach to everything in Appleby was just blowing my mind. I would see people in the street I hadn't seen for 3 years and they'd say, oh, have you been away? So I came back out to Lower Hutt, picked up my same job again, except by now the rabbit work had closed down and I'd been assigned to join a team on forest ecology in the Arongaronga Valley in the southern Rimutaka. It was a new study site and the whole approach was to make a very integrated, intensive study of the ecology of a patch of temperate rainforest. And I found myself with a group working on possums. None of us had worked on possums before. And I was asked if I could find a way of finding out where possums went at night.
Mm-hmm.
How far did they go?
Mm.
The standard technique was to put out traps. And over a period of time, you catch these animals in traps. You mark them, tattoo their ears, put coloured bands in them. And over a period of time, from the traps you caught them in, you'd be able to picture of where
they were going, sure.
But we didn't know whether they would have gone there if there hadn't been a trap with a bait in it, or if they hadn't gone into the trap, how much further they may have travelled. They needed to know. It was the early days realising that possums were spreading bovine TB. We needed to know how far possums were travelling. So I did a lot of reading, a lot of research, and it was the early days of radio tracking. I corresponded with a number of people who had published papers on the early years, the early days of radio tracking. And I worked with, I should say that this was in the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research at DSIR, which had 22 different divisions. And one of the divisions was called the Physics and Engineering Division, where they had some excellent electronics people. I made contact with them, and with me setting down the specifications I needed, and them going on a learning curve to find out how they could meet these impossible specifications, we finished up with a transmitter. I was the first person in New Zealand to put a transmitter on an animal. And I was given carte blanche to radio track 8 possums for 2 years in the Irongarongas. Going out, I used to track for three nights in a week, locating their positions, identifying which trees they were in. It's preparation for that over quite a large area. I mapped the whole area to start with, and a couple of students mapped all the trees in that area, precisely located. Everyone was numbered. Everyone, the species of everyone was identified. So we built up a very complex picture of what's going
that's
on.
That's amazing.
And I suddenly found myself the centre of activity because nobody else had done any radio tracking in the country.
True.
And I was giving papers at conferences. And probably the highlight of that was an invitation from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington.
Yes.
To attend, all expenses paid, attend a conference and present a paper on my work at the Smithsonian, which I did. And there was a girl went over with me as well. She'd been doing some very good work on identifying possum diet by teasing out possum droppings. Possums were then vegetarian. On the undersurface of a leaf, you have a pattern of stoma, the little holes through which plants breathe.
Yes.
I didn't know it, but those patterns are unique to the species, and the leaf cuticle is not digested. But if you take a possum dropping, tease it out in the right chemicals, you get these little floating pieces of cuticle. You can put it under a microscope, and you can say, ah, rata. Oh, he now. And she was doing this, identifying what the possums were eating and quantifying what they were eating as well.
Yes.
Like 37% was rata this week or last week. Or.
And coming back to your possum tracking, that really worked.
All clicked in together.
You found where the possums
the integration
went, what they were eating.
Was working.
Everything.
Yes. And she went to the Smithsonian too, and we gave a paper at this conference. And on the last night, we were having a wrap-up session that we probably 150 people from all over the world. A lot of monkey people from Africa, from the African continent. The title of the conference was Arboreal Folivores, Animals That Live Up Trees. And I was asked if I'd say a few words about radio tracking. And I finished up running a 2-hour workshop on radio tracking techniques. And I'd only been back here about 6 weeks, and I had a letter from somebody from that conference who was in Venezuela. He wanted to come and work in my laboratory for 6 months to learn radio tracking, and incredible. But from there, I continued to work with possums. With, again, with the engineering people, we developed a transmitter which could tell us what possums were doing by sound. This was a radio tag which could pick up the sound the possums were making. Which I was able to calibrate, putting possums in a pen and watching them and listening to them. And you could hear them breathing during the day. You could hear them snoring, chewing, scratching, grooming. You could hear the mouthparts. And I ran a 2-year study on that, which was very revealing, finding out not just where they were, but what they were doing.
Yes, yes.
To the extent of learning that on a filthy wet night in the Irongarongas, possums didn't feed. And they could go without food for days until they got so weak they just had to go out. And that's when you see possums out during the day. They're on their last legs. But things were ticking along nicely. I was involved in lots of other studies. By then I was a senior technical officer and was contributing in different ways to other studies. Mm. I was working with the director of the division who was studying the breeding of one of the species of wallabies, which is a major pest northeast of Rotorua. Can't remember which one it was now. But I was going up there every month with him, helping him to dissect wallabies, the local rabbit boards, before they were integrated and became part of regional
pest
council.
Destruction.
Pest destruction, that's right. Mm. They were doing the shooting. And we, over the course of 2 years, dissected almost 1,000 wallabies. They have a very clever reproductive strategy, but we won't go into it. In 1985, the writing was on the wall for the DSIR. The government of the day had decided that we had lived in luxury for a long time, mainly unaccountable to the taxpayer for what we did. Choosing what we did, it wasn't driven by economics or anything,
sure.
Just whim. And the writing was on the wall, and the first sign was that we were told to earn 30% of our research budget,
sure.
Which for a bunch of ecologists was frightening.
Mm.
For the industrial divisions, no problem. They already had contracts with industry, but we didn't.
Sure.
The director at the time was Richard Sadlier, Dr. Richard Sadlier. He called together the senior scientists and team leaders and brought in two marketing people to look at the division and what it could achieve in terms of raising revenue in some way. And we homed in on two options. One was what has become ecotourism, which then was putting people in the back of a Land Rover and going
sure.
for a cruise around the hills.
Yes, yes.
That was a definite starter, but there was no staff to do it. The staff were saying, but I'm a scientist. My job is research, not teaching other people about what could be done.
Mm.
The other one was making radio tracking equipment and selling it.
Mm.
I'd been making it, and it became such a big job that I'd started buying in from somebody else in Canada because I couldn't keep up with the
sure.
demand within the division. But that seemed to have a definite goal. And one afternoon, the last afternoon of this three-day get-together with all these people, the advertising people, the marketing people said, right, Dave, put a small group together. You've got 1 hour. I want a marketing plan. My experience of business was certainly in the horticultural industry.
Mm.
I'd seen a lot of the business side of it, including watching the bartering that goes on in Covent Garden.
Yeah.
But I did. I rang 2-3 people, extracted information from them under different pretexts, and put forward a business plan which seemed sound, and it was immediately accepted. And the story was, okay, Dave, go and start a company and start making radio tracking equipment. So I did. We didn't have a name, I didn't have a market, I didn't have a product.
Yes.
But we soon got a product. I employed the first technician for the job, a chap called Kevin Lay, who's a qualified radio technician, who was worth his weight in gold, I must say. I handled the business side, he handled the electronic side. We put together a nice little package of transmitters. I worked with some graphics people. We put a nice little chart together, and a flyer, and we swamped New Zealand, the universities, the government departments, anybody we thought might be interested in radio tracking. But it very quickly became obvious that New Zealand was too small.
Sure.
There just wasn't the demand.
Sure.
There wasn't the money either, because
yes,
it's quite
yes.
an expensive technique.
Yes.
So I opted to go to Australia, and we did the same in Australia, just all universities. There is a massive book which has a list. It lists all the universities, all the educational centres in
yes,
the world.
Yes, yes.
And you can find out what departments they have and who the head of department is.
Sure.
A very personalised approach. Mm. And it worked. We were the only company down here worth anything that could do what we said we could do.
Goodness me.
There was a company in Blenheim, a one-man band, who was making transmitters badly, with quite a high failure rate, which is very expensive when transmitters fail. And the business began to take off. We started in 86, by about 88, 89 we're beginning to get meaningful sales. And I started going over to Australia with an exhibition stand and attending major conferences and meeting customers firsthand. Sure. I'd already published papers on radio tracking, so my name was already out there. And I knew some of the leading scientists because I corresponded earlier with their problems and offering suggestions, solving them. And the company slowly grew from there. By 94, I'd taken the company with a staff of six through the whole of the ISO certification process for quality control. We were the smallest company in the country to achieve that at the time.
Sure.
That year we ran at a loss. It was an expensive exercise.
Sure.
But it was absolutely essential for us to get our act together.
Yes.
I could go away for a month overseas and I knew everything would run like clockwork.
Sure.
There was a procedure for everything.
Sure, sure.
And the staff had written those procedures or created them,
yes,
and I'd written them.
Yes.
And they had ownership of it.
Sure.
So very much their involvement.
Yes.
And that was a driving force throughout the development of CERTRAC, was the involvement of the staff and ownership by the staff,
sure,
of everything,
sure,
we did.
Yes.
Rather than do this, do that. You don't ask questions.
Yes.
So.
It's amazing. And so during those periods, you obviously extended your radio tracking from possums and to lots of other species that we hear about.
Oh, yes.
Birds that fly half the world.
That's right, yes.
So what other birds?
Where do I begin? When I retired in 2004... we had designed radio transmitters for almost 600 different species of birds, reptiles, insects. And what set CERTRAC apart from everybody else, because by now there were something like 30 other companies manufacturing, some of them very big companies, was that we custom built everything. The other companies that would have at these exhibitions a row of transmitters, and if they, you could walk up to them and say, well, I want a transmitter for a lesser marmot, and they'd say, well, this one.
Yes.
And you could say, but that collar's too wide, I want it narrower. No, that's the one you want. There's no compromise. That's model A1274. Whereas we would say, okay, how wide do you want the collar? How long? How do you want to fasten it? And we'd custom build, and the business rolled in.
That's amazing. And it's still going strong?
No. No. When I retired, the board of directors, who were appointed by Landcare Research,
yes,
who owned the company,
yes,
they took over from the DSIR in 1990. The board of directors waited 18 months before finding a replacement for me, even though I'd given them a full year's notice that I was leaving.
Sure.
The replacement had a different idea of where the company should go or how it should go. I'd taken the company as far as I could. I had a staff when I retired, a staff of 16 full-time, 4 part-time.
Mm-hmm.
It needed somebody who was knowledgeable about overseas manufacturing, contract manufacturing, that sort of thing. Mike had that quality or that ability, but he overloaded the company with design engineers. The company was too small to support 5 full-time design engineers earning big salaries.
Mm.
So he was running at a loss. They did complete a very good R&D program, which I'd originally put in place. But Mike was eventually sent down the road.
Who was that, Mike?
Kelly.
Yes.
Kelly was in... he was from Liverpool. He had a degree in electronics. And he was working for a company in Christchurch manufacturing medical scooters.
Yes, I actually did meet him down there. I think I met him maybe when you were still there at the end of your period.
No overlap there at all.
That's interesting. So that really was the demise of Certrac as a local company.
Yes. In the meantime, Landcare had sold it. Landcare sold Certrac. It was a cash cow for them. But throughout its life, the CEO of Landcare, a chap called Andy Pierce, Dr. Andy Pierce, was being questioned by government personnel, why do you own a company that makes radio tracking equipment? Andy always had a good answer and could justify it, but there was pressure on, for God's sake, get rid of it, you know, it's not your field. And eventually, after I'd left, I'd been left 5-6 years.
Yes.
It went on the market. And one of our rivals in Canada, a company called Lowtech, bought it. Lowtech had made its name radio tracking salmon in the Columbia River Basin in Northwest America. And they'd made a huge amount of money out of it. It was a massive project. There was something like 300 dams on the river.
Yes, yes.
And they had directional antennas on every dam.
Good Lord.
Monitoring the movement of salmon up and down, and thousands of salmon carrying transmitters. But whenever anybody went to Lowtech saying, you know, anybody said, well, we want some transmitters for elephants or lions or snakes, and Lowtech fronted up, they'd say, oh, but you're fish people, we don't want you.
Yes.
So they bought Certrac. They bought the opportunity to get into the other market. And two people left straight away. Lowtech is a notoriously tough company to work for.
Sure.
You perform or you're down the road.
Yes, sure.
End of story. And nobody's going to work for
them. Yes, yes.
Two left. Morale dropped seriously. Kevin Lay became very unhappy. And we were already, had already been working very closely with a company in North America called Wildlife Computers. He got a job with Wildlife Computers on the sales side, and he declared that to Mike, and he was run off the site straight away.
Right?
Get your things, go. Two other people left. He downsized the R&D. Somebody else left to go, and he had a degree in agriculture, and he went to work for Silverfern Farms. And his job was ensuring that the Silverfern Farm network could maintain a year-round supply of meat for McDonald's. Full-time job. The feeling with Certrac now is that I think the staff is down to something like 20, or up to 46.
So they're manufacturing under the umbrella of their parent company in Canada.
The parent company. But they are, I understand, are being micromanaged. Yes. And everybody's getting fed up.
And are they local still? Where does it operate from?
Still operates in Goddard Lane.
Does it really?
Still in the same building.
Oh, right.
Still got the same customers.
Yes, yes.
But it doesn't have a CEO here. It's all administered from Canada.
Isn't that an interesting story, though? You know, from woe to go, but the idea is still there.
Oh, yes.
That's still working.
Yes.
It's just that the people have all changed. amazing story.
Well, there are two of the staff now work for Wildlife Computers, based in Seattle. They both live in Havelock North. I don't know if they talk to each other, but they're both on the sales team.
Good Lord.
Handling different aspects of sales.
Sure.
Yes.
Seattle, is that in Canada?
No, it's
in America.
Washington State.
Just south of
just
Canada.
South of the
that's
border.
Right.
Vancouver, half an hour drive north.
What a story. And so then if we retrack back to you were married.
Yes.
And you had children, and we need to catch up on that side.
All right, that side of things.
Too, as well. Because that happened during your development of Certrac, or prior to?
I married another member of the rabbit team in the old ecology division of DSIR.
Did you really?
I did. And the common bond there was that we were both interested in ballroom dancing. And we both had gained gold medals in ballroom dancing. And we were both going to the same studio, and it was a case of, well, you two would make a great team. You were the right height, the right proportions. Think about it for competitions. So we did, and we got to know each other much better, and we finished up getting married.
Interesting, is it? Rock climbing to ballroom dancing. It doesn't really compute, does it? They both have a degree of precision.
Yeah, but it was not a good marriage. We had very little in common.
Yes.
We had very little in common with respect to aims and where we wanted to go and what we wanted to do. We had two daughters from the marriage, but the relationship was not a healthy one. It wasn't a good one. Daughters were doing well. They both went to St. Oran's College in Lower Hutt.
Mm.
But it was a marriage I walked away from. I made it quite clear, we either change direction or I'm out of here. And I did.
Mm.
During that time, another interesting development, in the early 70s, starting a new project, I needed to get a very large antenna high into the canopy of the forest in the Arongarong Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, I had to get first of all, a string over it, and then a rope.
Yes.
And that was notoriously difficult. And somebody had been throwing stones, and somebody walked past and said, hey, there's an old bow and arrow in the back of the workshop, you know, go and try that. Found the bow. The arrow was no good, but found the bow. And I went down to the Randwick Archery Club in Petone and said, look, could you show me how to use this thing? I've got a little job for it.
Mm.
And they died laughing. I'm like, it was an old wooden bow.
Yes.
But I got hooked. They gave me lent me some gear from the clubhouse to try. And I thought, this is me, archery.
Goodness me, sport. Robin Hood again.
And I got really involved in archery. And I became very good with a bow and arrow. And I developed a technique for putting a fishing line over a bough in the forest and weighting an arrow so it would actually be heavy enough to pull the
string
over and jiggle it down and then tie a string to that and then a cord and then a big rope. And in the end, this 10-foot antenna went right up into the 80 feet up into the canopy. And I was doing this we had one chap on staff, an ornithologist, who was putting up mist nets. Curtains of mist nets. They were going up probably 30 feet. And with him, it was a case of, he'd say, look, I want a mist net from there to there, I want a string over there.
Get Robin Hood to come down.
Which branch? That one on the left? What, about 6 inches to the right? Right.
Well, how did you time the velocity so it fell immediately beyond the branch and didn't go out over 20 other trees?
That's the skill, you see. But from there, I got very interested in coaching the kiddies at archery and then the adults. Olympic Solidarity, who is a spin-off from the Olympic movement, and do a lot of funding of Olympic development work.
Yes.
They put together a coaching course for archers or archery coaches in the Adelaide Hills.
Yes.
In 1980. And I was nominated by the National Council to attend, as were three others from New Zealand. Mm. And I went on that course, beautiful, amazing course for coaches. Learned a hell of a lot about technique and technology as well.
Mm.
But when I came back, I was made the National Coach of the New Zealand Archery Association, just like that.
So was that the days when the lass that used to shoot from a wheelchair was active?
And with a guy called Bernie Fraser, not the rugby player, the other Bernie Fraser, he and I put together a national squad, selectors, and we started running workshops for the national squad, and Nerrilee was in the national squad, and I took the national squad to the Australian Championships, where we cleaned up totally. We dropped two or three out of it because they weren't performing. I finished up with two girls.
Mm.
I took them to Japan. This is building up for Commonwealth Games in Brisbane. And Nerrilee on her own, and against my good advice, went to China for national championships, where she got wiped totally, just not in that class. But she got over that, and we went to the Brisbane Commonwealth Games in 1982, and she won gold. And the other girl, she came fourth. She lost it on the last end, the last 6 hours.
Right.
She should have got a bronze, but the pressure was huge.
Yes, obviously you're a good leader and a good imparter of knowledge. Obviously people listen to you, because wherever you've been, you've been in that leadership role, haven't you?
I'm not an impatient person, but I like to see things done. I like to make it happen.
Yes.
People stand around and argue about things and, oh, this is too... I say, look, let's just do it.
Yes.
I'll find out about this. You find out about that. Yep. Find out how much that costs and where we can get it from.
Yep.
We'll do it.
Yes.
Yeah. But in the meantime, I'd remarried. My two girls were still at St. Oran's College.
Yes.
Sharon had two boys.
Sure.
And we're very happily married for almost 30 years.
And the two boys, where are they? In New Zealand, or are they?
Matt became a automotive trimmer. He runs his own business in Napier, and he specialises in classic cars. Does the most amazing work in upholstery.
Yes.
And last year, landed a contract with Dickie Boats, who I'd never heard of before. But at Ahuriri, there is a boat building company which is banging boats through 35 footers, and he's doing all the upholstery for them. And it's like a sausage machine. The boat comes in, it's assembled, gather it's a kit set kind of thing. Mm. It goes up to Tauranga, where it's painted, comes back here, where it's then finished and upholstered. Then it does sea trials.
Yes.
As that one's going out for sea trials, there's another kit set coming in. So, yeah, he's having a wonderful time.
Yes.
Stressed a little, but...
And your other son?
Other son, Adam. Adam went to university, Massey. Did a degree in, I'm not sure what the topic would have been, but it was something like landscape management or environmental studies or something like that.
Chip off the old block, sort of?
Yeah, a bit of influence there. Because he was only three when we got together. He then decided to do, he got a job with MWH, which is an international engineering company. Mm. And he was looking after the ecological side of the work that they were doing, like, okay, you're going to build a bridge, but what about the creek underneath? You've got to keep the lead paint out of it and all that sort of stuff. Or auditing the environmental side of the engineering work they were doing. And he was doing very well. He decided he wanted an MSc.
Yes.
So he started an MSc part-time and passed with honours three, 4 years later. And in that time, he also decided he could do all this work on his own. He didn't need MWH, so started his own consultancy.
Right.
And decided he was doing a PhD as well, which he'll finish this year. In the meantime, gone through a divorce, found a new partner who's currently doing an MSc in nursing. Oh. She's lecturing at EIT.
And what about the girls?
Well, Karen, the eldest... Karen went to university, she did a degree in accountancy and a degree in business management, joined Price Waterhouse as an auditor, and was an auditor here for 3 years, and then transferred to Price Waterhouse in London, and was an auditor there for about 3 years. Mm. Talk about jammy, most Kiwis go to the UK for OE, and they spend their time wondering where the next crust is coming from with a pack on their back.
Yes.
She went all over Britain, train, plane, best hotels, all expenses paid, and then she decided she could do better. So she left Price Waterhouse and started doing contract work for a major bank in London, a bank that just in that building alone employed 1,000 people.
Yes.
And she would do a contract. She's very good at computer work, I should say.
Sure.
She would do a contract for 5 months and then take 2 months off and go trekking in Africa. Come back, another contract, 9 months, and then she'd go travel the length of South America with Contiki Adventures or something. And she saw a lot of the world like that. Came back in gosh, hard to put a date on it now. She was over there for 9 years.
Yes.
Came back, got married. She was leading a team in telecom, team managing telecom's internal finances.
Yes.
Not the customer stuff, but how telecom were managing. Telecom moved their headquarters to Auckland about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and she found herself without a job. They wanted her to reapply and move to Auckland, but she said no. They live in Karori in Wellington. So in that time, in that meantime, she got married, have two children. Her husband has his own business as a quantity surveyor, specialising in supermarkets. Did all the supermarkets in the Bay. Just turned down a supermarket development in Tamatea. He's winding down his business. He wants a change. But in the meantime, Karen's just done 2 years with Transpower.
Transpower.
She works for Transpower.
Well, it's the most natural name, isn't it?
And she's just finished a contract with them, working on a 20-year financial plan.
Right.
She's very wise to, yeah.
Now, we all forget things. I've forgotten your wife's name.
Sharon.
Yes. Now, Sharon, 30 years, you know, obviously she had some contribution too.
Oh, huge.
And, you know, what was her background?
Sharon's background was, what would you call it? Her background was a secretarial background. Sure. She was a shorthand typist.
Right.
Okay. And then she moved on to, ticker tape, telegraph, whatever it was called.
And it wasn't Morse, but it was the other one.
Yeah.
Yes, I took over. Yes, I know the one you mean.
And she worked for Chamber of Commerce in Wellington. Telegraphy.
That's right.
She decided she wanted to travel. She went to England. She was three quarters Irish. She caught up with a lot of family over there. Very proud of being Irish. And she did a number of jobs over there. Typical OE. Finishing up working for an electronics company on the admin side. When she came back here, she got married, she started a family. I first met her in archery. She came along, she wanted to take up archery. Right. She was given, allotted to one of the coaches, and after about 3 months, she'd gone to the organiser of coaching, saying, look, I'm not getting anywhere. And he was a traffic cop.
Yes.
Every time I come for a coaching class, he's been called out somewhere. Could I have another coach? So she was brought along to me and said, Dave, I'd like you to meet Sharon.
You've got a lifetime coach for leading her. Isn't it amazing how little twists in life?
I know.
Just, and it's almost as if they're meant to happen.
Yeah, it's just incredible. So I was going through a divorce process, or separation at that stage, and it wasn't long before, well, she was living in quite a violent marriage, black eyes and things, terrible mess, and she got out, she went to live with mum for a while, and then we got together, and I was in Lower Hutt until 84, then I was transferred up here to Havelock North. You would know or heard of Bob Brockie. Bob Brockie writes a science column in the Dominion Post on a Monday. Yes. Bob used to work for the ecology division of DSIR. We worked together. One of the reasons I was sent up here was because Bob had set out a whole set of studies on possums out on the Herotonga Plains.
Yes.
But Bob was a post-polio victim.
Oh.
He had polio when he was young, came right and was getting around, but apparently after you've had polio, later in life it comes back to bite you in the bum, because all the other things you've been straining to keep moving are not used to that strain and they begin to pack up on. Bob now is confined to a wheelchair. But Bob was the real reason I was sent up here. And up here they were using radio tracking equipment not very well, and the director of the day, Richard Sadley, wanted to establish a recognisable electronics laboratory for the whole division. So I was given the job of setting that up here as well.
I think the first time I met you was in
Elliot Crescent.
I met you both there. That was, and I don't know whether we were selling your house.
You were selling.
And
or you were looking at selling.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. We were too. And see, that goes back a fair way too.
It does. Actually, no, we were buying. We were looking to buy.
Yes.
Because we'd already, we were on the market with...
Ian Scott.
No.
No, no.
No. She lived in Miritai. Husband and wife team. And they moved to Auckland.
Well, anyway, then yeah. I remember talking to Ian Scott, who was looking on your behalf, and I told him, and told you,
yeah,
have a look at this one.
Oh, that was when we were looking for this place. Since then, we'd moved from Elliot Crescent, and we had a place in Selwyn Road, and it was moving from Selwyn Road.
That's
we'd
right.
already sold Selwyn
yes,
Road.
That's right. Well, I didn't know your Selwyn Road property.
Okay.
But I directed Ian and you
that's
to
right.
this one.
And so Sharon walked in here and said, the room, the space, it's got to be ours.
I know. So yeah, so that really makes a wonderful story, Dave. And
very jumbled.
Anything else that you think of or, you know, obviously surprising just how there were so many things that happened, but a lot of them I think you made happen.
Could have been.
Yes, yes.